My beloved brethren and sisters in Christ Jesus, we have now come to the focal point of our fraternal gathering this week, where we center our minds on these emblems on the table before us. And it is fitting, when we consider the Song of Songs, which are Solomon's, to focus on the fifth chapter for this morning. The fifth chapter is not about the bride, but it is the bride looking at the bridegroom as we sit here this morning and focus on Christ. Unfortunately, the chapter starts off on a different note, a different mood than what we have seen. The bridegroom is absent. He has withdrawn himself. He came to his bride and he found her sleeping and the door locked. In the second verse it says, "I sleep, but my heart wakeneth. It is the voice of my beloved that knocketh, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled, for my head is filled with dew, and my locks with the drops of the night." Israel, the bride, knew that the time of her Messiah was nigh. Their hearts longed for deliverance, but when he appeared, she was asleep. Verse 3, "I have put off my coat, how shall I put it on? I have washed my feet, how shall I defile them?" She was afraid to go with him for fear of defiling herself. Jesus associated with the publicans and sinners, with the Samaritans. He spoke against their rituals, which they depended on for their righteousnesses. She had put off her garments. She was asleep, naked, and comfortable when the knock on the door came. By the time she awakes and recognizes who he was, he is gone. It wasn't until the day of Pentecost when the true bride recognized her failure. "Men and brethren, what shall we do?" was their question. The true bride then begins her search for him. She is found by the watchmen, the spiritual leaders in charge of protecting and keeping the people safe. And they abuse and mistreat her. I'll let the bride tell the story herself. Verse 6. "I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had withdrawn himself and was gone. My soul fainted while he spake. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. The watchmen that went about the city found me. They smote me. They wounded me. The keepers of the wall took away my veil from me." Christ warned that his true bride would be mistreated and would be persecuted in his absence. And here we have a repeat of what we heard yesterday, a repeat of what transpired in chapter 3. "I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer." The bride is out searching for the bridegroom, unable to find him. She understands that he has promised to return and redeem her. And yet the bride, those who truly recognize Christ for what he is and who he is, will allow nothing but his presence to satisfy her. So she ventures out into the public and is mistreated. And the question is asked, in this chapter. The implied question, why? Why would you put yourself through this? Why continue to go out in search of him when it only means trouble? Why not go along with your daily business just like everyone else? And her response is in verse 8. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if ye find my beloved, that ye tell him that I am sick of love. Tell him that I am lovesick. What is the most important, the most urgent message for him to receive from her? Note that it is not how much she has endured, not how long she has suffered, not the blows, the wounds, the injuries, the affronts. Nothing, none of those things. The only one thing that mattered, one thing that was utmost in her mind and under which she would die if not satisfied. Tell him that I am lovesick. So strong is her desire for him that nothing else matters. Brothers and sisters, is that the way we feel about Christ? Are we truly a lovesick bride for our absent Lord? Why should the bride endure this mistreatment, these problems for her beloved? Verse 9. What is thy beloved more than others, beloved? Why be different and deprive ourselves of the great things that the world has to offer? What is so special about your beloved, about your religion? Are not we asked this question often? Why not just join the local church and help our community? Why stay separate? What is thy beloved more than another beloved, O thou fairest among women? What is thy beloved more than another beloved that thou so chargest us? What does Christ mean to you? Are you really willing to sacrifice present advantage to serve him? Is it all worthwhile? Many are simply motivated by the thought, what is in it for me? What will I get out of it? If I must give up a lot, why? And the answer is love. Tell him that I am lovesick. Nothing else. It's like the adversary asked Job, does Job serve God for naught? Look what he's got. And it was proven that Job didn't serve God for what was in it for him. The true bride is, I'm doing it because I am lovesick. It's all out of love, nothing else. Nothing else is important to her. Paul says, yea, doubtless, and I count all things but lost for the excellency of the knowledge of Jesus Christ my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and do count them but dung, that I might win Christ. That's the attitude. Moses, esteeming the reproaches of Christ greater riches than everything that Egypt had to offer him. And then we have the example here on the table before us, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down on the right hand of the throne of God. Herein is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. The whole book, the whole of the Bible, is about love. This gathering is to develop that frame of mind in us, a disposition, a character of love for the bridegroom. The bride answers this question, what is thy beloved more than another, by giving a detailed description of her beloved. It is a review of the chief characteristics of God manifested in the flesh, the bridegroom, of whom each and every one of us hope to be incorporated into. The question as we look at these characteristics, brethren and sisters, the question that we must contemplate this morning is how many, if any, of these characteristics do we presently manifest? Where are we lacking? And probably most important, what are we doing about it? The bride, the true ecclesia, describes her beloved. And what is the first characteristic that we see? What is uppermost and most important? Verse 10. My beloved is white and ruddy, the chiefest among 10,000. He is white. Whiteness shows purity, righteousness, which was the foundation of Christ's character and that which must be the foundation of our character. The word white connotes shining, brightness, brilliance. I want you to listen to how the writers of the gospel described what they saw on the Mount of Transfiguration when they saw Christ the way that his Father always saw him. I feel that they're struggling to put into words things that words cannot describe. The whiteness of the bridegroom. Matthew says, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. How white is that? Mark says, and his raiment became shining, exceedingly white. White as snow, so as no fuller on earth can whiten them. It became whiter than you can make anything white. Luke records, the fashion of his countenance was altered, and his raiment was white and glistening. My beloved is white and ruddy. The root word for the word ruddy is Adam, red. We see here the twofold aspect of Christ. Although the righteous aspect of his character is overwhelming, it would be all in vain had it not been for his nature, the same as ours, the same problems, the same struggles that we endure. He is white and ruddy. Chiefest among 10,000. The word chiefest literally means standard bearer, ensign, banner, as we heard yesterday. The one we rally around for victory and conquest. He is the conqueror of sin and death. And if we live under his banner, we also will be partakers of the victory celebration. Verse 11. His head is as the most fine gold. Gold is faith. Fine gold has been tried in the fire. Refined gold. The beloved. The head of gold, tried and refined, our head. The covering of the ark, the mercy seat, was pure gold. Ultimately, every member of the body must appear as he is and be united as one to the head. We must all be pure gold. God told Ezekiel, he says, Son of man, the house of Israel is become unto me dross. The process, instead of refining and extracting the gold, left only dross as far as God was concerned. The trials can work either way. All God could find after Israel was tried was the dross. Brothers and sisters, our trials are designed to refine and purify and make us more valuable. Let it not make us simply dross. The beloved's head is pure, fine gold. In all points, tempted or tried like as we, yet without sin. Faithful even unto death. The betrothed finds in her beloved a true sympathizer and comforter in times of affliction, in times of sorrow and trials. Verse 11 continues. His head is as the most fine gold. His locks are bushy and black as a raven. We read concerning hair in Numbers chapter 6, verse 18. The responsibility of the Nazarite. We read, And the Nazarite shall shave the head of his separation at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and shall take the hair of the head of his separation and put it in the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. The hair of separation offered in sacrifice to God. The strength, the goodness devoted to God, which allowed the peace offering or the fellowship offering with God. We think of Samson when we think of hair. long hair, strength, bushy black hair. If it were gray, we say someone with gray hair, we think of someone growing old, going downhill, changing. We see in description of Christ, black, bushy hair, young, health, strength. Verse 12, his eyes are as the eyes of doves by the river of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. And we heard about the eyes yesterday and doves' eyes. Eyes not only receive information and implant it onto the brain, eyes also reflect what's on the brain. The eyes can show fear, anger, love. A dove's eyes shows mildness, harmlessness, chaste, faithfulness. The dove was the only bird offered as a sacrifice. It was a clean bird, and yet the Jews never ate it. The Jews used it to symbolize harmlessness. In its sacrificial use, it set forth the same principle that the lamb did. It was less expensive, but it was the same symbol. We saw the talk this morning about symbols. The symbol for the dove and the symbol for the lamb were the same. Innocence, perfection. In chapter 1, verse 15, the bride is praised by the groom with these words. This is the groom looking at the bride and saying, behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes. When we arrive at the judgment seat, when Christ looks us into the eyes, will he see a reflection of himself? Will he see his own dove's eyes in ours? If our eyes reveal anything else, then we have fallen short of our goal. Let us now examine ourselves while there is still time. When speaking of eyes, we cannot omit the concept of perception and discernment, his perfect knowledge and understanding of all things, his ability to read the innermost thoughts, our innermost needs and wants. This can be both very comforting and very disconcerting. However, knowing this, once again, causes us to examine ourselves. Are our words, our thoughts, our deeds his eyes sees all. His eyes, we're told, are washed with milk and fitly set. We are to desire the sincere milk of the word. Eyes washed with milk means pure and godly vision, a cleansed and enlightened outlook, viewing all things, understanding all things by the light of the gospel. They are clear and fitly set. They're neither far-sighted, seeing only things afar off, nor are they nearsighted, able only to see things close at hand. They are perfect eyes, properly focused, fitly set. Verse 13, his cheeks are as a bed of spices, as sweet flowers, his lips like lilies dropping sweet-smelling myrrh. I want to quote Brother Grocott on this verse where he says, the flower bloom of eternal youth and beauty. All things except Christ grow old and die. Nothing in life is lasting, but of him it is said, thou hast the dew of thy youth. They shall perish, but thou remainest. Thou art the same, thy years shall not fail. The greatest of present joys must so quickly pass into sorrow and loss and final loneliness. But Christ is ever young and ever new. It is hard to really enjoy anything we know must at last and before long pass away. We have all experienced intense pleasure, which in their very enjoyment have been saddened from knowing that in a short time they would be over and would never return. On only a slightly larger scale, this is life itself. But there is more to cheek than this. Cheek or cheeks occur 11 times in the scripture, other than in this song. In all but two, and even one of these is related, there is a reference to submission, to smiting and affliction. They smote the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek. Micah 5:1. If any man smite thee on the one cheek, turn to him the other also. Matthew 5:39. Cheek, therefore, inescapably turns our mind to the patient submission to abuse and loss and suffering for righteousness' sake. This is that what gave Christ all his value and his beauty and his present never-ending bloom of youth. Unquote. Verse 13 says, his cheeks are as a bed of spices, as sweet flowers, his lips like lilies dropping sweet-smelling myrrh. When we think of lily, we use the term something is lily white. We think of purity. But this does not seem to be the scriptural use of the word lily. The Bible lilies ranged in color from purple to pink. And it seems that their scriptural significance is that it was God's bestowed beauty. It was God's inherent glory as contrasted with human superficial beauty and glory. We read in Matthew 6, and why take ye thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Wherefore, if God so clothed the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? When we compare the work of man to that of God, which we see the lily is the reference to, the God-bestowed work and beauty, we find a major difference. The closer we scrutinize the work of man, the more defects we find. While just the opposite is true, the more we scrutinize the work of God. We look at a picture that a person painted, and if we look at it from across the room, it looks like a beautiful picture. But if we get up close to it, we see blotches of paint. the beauty of the picture is lost. And if we were to take that picture and examine it under a microscope, it even looks worse. We see bumps and lumps and bubbles. No beauty at all. Something very unattractive. But if, on the other hand, we take the work of God, we look at a field of lilies, it looks beautiful. And if we were to examine it up close and look at one lily, it looks even more beautiful. And if we take one petal of that lily and we put it under a microscope, even more beauty and intricacies, delicacies that were not apparent to the naked eye come into view. The beauty is not diminished in any way, but enhanced the closer we look. And the same is true with the words of man and the words of God. We examine man's works closely, we find spots and blemishes, even in the most admired of men's works. But the more Christ's words are searched, the more minutely we get into it, the more intricately we study it, new beauties are brought to light. The more the perfection appears. The discoveries of science, the researchers of the learned, and even the laborers of the unbelieving infidel, all alike work together to prove the harmony, the beauty, the oneness of the words of Christ. How better could you describe his lips than lips like lilies? You know, it always interests me. The scripture records something that I'm probably willing to say is the strangest reason ever given for officers failing to arrest their suspect. Then came the officers to the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said unto them, "Why have ye not brought him?" The officers answered, "Never a man spake like this man." They failed to arrest him because his lips were like lilies. Never a man spake like this man. And all bare him witness and wondered at the gracious words that proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, "Is not this Joseph's son? The words that I speak, they are spirit, and they are life." How sweet were those lips to the sick, the lame, the blind, the weary. To them it would be like sweet dropping myrrh, a delightful perfume, life-giving, bringing health, happiness, and redemption. To them, and brothers and sisters, to us also. So as we should be able to say, his lips like lilies, dropping sweet-smelling myrrh. Verse 14, his hands are as gold rings set with the beryl. Rings are a symbol of sonship, royalty, authority. Nearly every reference to rings in the scriptures, from Pharaoh's ring that was given to Joseph to the father's ring that was placed on the hand of his prodigal son, carries the same meaning. An inseparable part of the beauty of Christ was his relationship to God, his universal majesty and authority based on his faithfulness to his Father. a ring of gold. This is my beloved Son. All power is given to me in heaven and in earth. Verse 14 continues, his belly is as bright ivory, overlaid with sapphires. This word belly, throughout the scriptures, this word is translated bowels. It means internal organs. The Hebrew lexicon sums it up as internal parts. Psalm 51 says, thou desirest truth in the inward parts. The burnt offering, a sacrifice that not only had to be inspected and be without spot and blemish, but when it was handed over to the priest would skin it, flay it, and inspect the inward parts for blemish. It was inspected inside as well as outside before it was an acceptable offering, whole burnt offering to God. The bridegroom's inner organs are described as bright ivory overlaid with sapphire. The word for bright literally means elaborately worked so as to shine. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 5 gives us the idea. A body hast thou prepared me. The point is the preparation, the inward working, developing, perfecting. He learned obedience by the things which he suffered. Anything in our life that contributes to this process is good. And no matter how hard it may seem, it is really a blessing. That is why we're told that sorrow is better than laughter. But anything, brethren and sisters, that detracts from this process, no matter how enjoyable it may be, is a curse. And we must look at it as a curse. Finely wrought ivory overlaid with sapphires. Ivory was always a symbol of splendor. And so we have the inward parts, the inward splendor of a perfect character. Absolutely beautiful inward parts. Verse 15, his legs are as pillars of marble, set upon sockets of fine gold. Legs. Here we have the representation of strength. Pillars of marble. Beauty. Stability. Standing upon what? Gold. Tried faith. Standing in strength. We can contrast this with David in despair. When his sin was brought to his attention, he said, if thou, Lord, shouldest mark iniquity, O Lord, who? Who would stand? It's a rhetorical question. He knew the answer to that. If God was to mark iniquity, not one of us would stand. The beloved stands. And brethren and sisters, he offers us the opportunity to stand with him. Verse 15 continues, his countenance is as Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. The bride now refers to the entire appearance of her beloved, as Lebanon exceeds all the other mountains in the land for magnitude and beauty, so she sees her beloved. He will be the head of that great mountain, that will fill the whole earth. Verse 16, his mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely. This is not the common word for mouth, but rather, as the margin shows, palate. The idea is that of taste rather than speech. We covered speech with the consideration of his lips like lilies. Here the reference is to discernment and choice of that which is wholesome and good, and the rejection of everything that is in the slightest way fleshly or evil and impure. Job asked the question, doth not the ear try words, and the mouth taste his meat? The lesson is that taste, appeal, desire is not an unchanging force that we have to cater to, but it is something that we develop. It's a delicate capacity to be trained and shaped to spiritual ends. The first time we prepare a talk or a class or talk to a stranger, a neighbor, someone at work, it's uncomfortable to us. It may not taste right in our mouth. We're not comfortable. But it is something we can develop. A child's untrained taste rejects a wide variety of foods. They desire only sweet. But as they develop, the adult learns that bitterness mixed with the sweetness is much richer and more satisfying. How sweet are thy words unto my taste. Yea, sweeter than honey to my mouth. And so she concludes her description of her beloved. Yea, he is altogether lovely. Once again, Brother Grocott says, the beauty of Christ is his perfection. Nothing out of harmony, nothing to detract. No danger of later discovering flaws to disappoint and disillusion. Nothing to fear from the cruel, unsparing microscope of intimate familiarity. The more minutely we examine him, the more beautiful he is revealed to be. This is the pattern of God that he has set before us, the idea to which he would have us ceaselessly to strive, the ultimate to which he will finally elevate the faithful, his bride. This is my beloved, and this is my friend. Henceforth I call you not servants, for a servant knoweth not what his Lord doeth, but I have called you friends. For all things that I have heard of my Father, I have made known unto you. Greater love hath no man than this, than that a man lay down his life for his friends. Ye are my friends, if ye do whatsoever I command you.